American History Effed, Part 2, The Way. Quote, "It is the absolute right of the state to supervise the formation of public opinion," unquote. Joseph Goebbels. And I apologize in advance for the echo.
What do you think of this? The parents of four Montgomery County children under arrest for failing to register their homeschooled children with the school district 7 years ago. How is this allowed to happen? Who should be held accountable? Fact finder Marcia Natal went and got some answers.
Is it fair to say that these four children fell through the cracks?
Well, from what I can gather, it sounds like there was education going on, so I don't know if they really slipped through the cracks. They didn't fulfill their legal responsibilities to file with the school district to be homeschooled.
Dr. Richard Hoffman, superintendent of Fonda Fultonville Schools, didn't become aware until mid-December that four children ages 8 to 14 who lived in the town of Glen for 7 years were never registered with the district, but were being homeschooled by their parents, Richard and Margie Cressy.
How did you not know that these four kids were not being educated or schooled?
Well, school districts as a rule do not have detectives out to see who is and who isn't. We count on parents to follow the law, which is that all students between the ages of 6 and 16 need to be educated.
The Cressys were arrested on charges of child endangerment. Police began investigating after an anonymous tip. Under state law, a superintendent must approve a homeschooling curriculum. But according to investigators, the Cressys never submitted one in the 7 years they lived in the district.
So who should be held accountable here?
Well, the parents. It's not the school's fault. The schools are doing the right thing, trying to get the parents to file the proper paperwork, which they have now.
According to Hoffman, the Cressys have now submitted a homeschooling curriculum, and he has approved it.
Will anything be done differently from the school's point of view to make sure that schools or kids are being homeschooled correctly, or?
Well, we follow the law, and the law requires us to make sure that certain steps are followed.
Marcy Natal, CBS 6 News, Fonda.
Critical thinking questions. In school, we are led to believe that we are all living in someone's ideal vision of what society should be. And this is actually pretty true. But whose vision is it? What were their ideals? And all things considered, does this even really matter? Episode of School Sucks podcast, we were discussing the presentation of history in our public schools, listen to my language, in the government schools. Now, I really didn't feel like I needed to elaborate too much on why history is boring and distant, and it doesn't make any sense. The books present the stories in a bland and vague way. They subtract important details that might work against the positive image of America that the books and the curriculum try to portray. So we're not obviously getting a very accurate picture of what has happened in this country that leads up to now. But there's actually something that I left out, and I think it's perhaps one of the most fascinating and disturbing aspects of the way history is presented in government school. And you know what? The path that this leads down, what I'm about to talk about, is even more fascinating. And for some, for many, if you believe it, far more disturbing when we get to our destination. This undertaking is not a complex research project. It initially does not even require us to open a book, but merely to look at the cover. If you grabbed a stack of history textbooks, social studies textbooks, currently being used in public school, you might notice that their titles tend to have a common thread running through them. Here's a few. The United States, A History of the Republic. The American Tradition. The Challenge of Democracy. The Triumph of the American Nation. And of course, the American Way. Now, all these books, without even opening them, seem to suggest something, that history is a single thing. It is a story that has been agreed upon. When we open the book and we start reading it, it appears that this single story is being told by a single omniscient voice. There are no questions left. There is no stone that has not been turned over. The story, this one story, this one tradition, this one heritage or way is known. And you can learn about it from this book the same way, like I said before, you're going to learn about chemistry or physics or grammar from a book. Somebody who knows all this stuff wrote it, and they are going to tell you about it. But that happens after we open the book, and we don't even need to do that. We're just looking at the cover. Oh, it also appears to be, like, illegal to publish a textbook if you're not going to put a picture of either an eagle, Mount Rushmore, or the Statue of Liberty on the cover. It's got to have one of those three. If you can work in all three, great. But this presentation begs the question, what is the American way? Whose vision of a society are we living? And this is where it starts to get a little bit more complicated. A basic history, which is what most people get in school, will tell you that you have absolutely nothing to worry about. You, as an American, are just kicking it on a absolutely majestic plot of land currently playing host to the ideal society. And you're so lucky because it was America's history started out with, well, I mean, it depends on where you want to start the story. Do you want to start with the brave sailor who defied the idea that the earth was flat? That's something that I forgot to mention last time had already been known for at least 1,000 years, probably longer. Do you want to start the story with the brave pilgrims who were seeking religious freedom? Do you want to start the story with the first Thanksgiving? Do you want to start the story with the founding fathers and the Declaration of Independence? Now, we'll start with the Declaration of Independence. And today, let's be fair, okay? Like, kids get some idea in the 21st century at the high school level. Kids are getting some idea that Columbus was not some purely heroic figure, that his arrival and a lot of the things that he did, or that his men did while they were here, I think there was 3 trips total between 1492 and I think 1507. I'm not good with dates because dates aren't important, right? It's not like names and dates and terms is what history in school is all about. That's why it's so friggin' boring. It's not about ideas. So I don't know the dates, but Columbus was here 3 times. A lot of people died. People got their hands hacked off. They were treated like animals. They were turned into slaves and brought back to Spain. was not a good scene. And I think today kids get some idea of that reality. Then we could, you know, the Pilgrims, which is not as tragic as Columbus, a little bit more amusing, that they come here supposedly for religious freedom. And of course, the textbooks, the curriculum, the state standards would totally play up this aspect of the story, this search for religious freedom, because it fits in so well with the rest of American mythology. It's like the ultimate prologue. The Pilgrims were oppressed in Britain, so they set out bravely on a quest to find a place where they could practice their religious beliefs with freedom. And as luck would have it, they landed on the future site of the world's freest country. Plymouth Rock, by the way, is a bog that the ship got stuck in. But a rock, that makes a way better story. Landed on a rock. That's solid. But our history is devoid of connection. So this wonderful story overlooks the fact that three generations later, they were drowning each other and hanging each other and crushing each other with rocks over suspicions of witchcraft, which resulted from people who did not want to follow the extraordinarily strict dogma of their religion, which is strange. But that also is kind of a follow-up to the story of Columbus and the arrival of the Spanish, who came to the New World not just to bring genocide and disease, but also Christianity. Now, the Arawak people, I think that Zinn in the People's History of the United States estimates that there might have been 500,000 or so of them living in the Bahamas, and they basically vanished within a century. But it's kind of an interesting idea. The Spanish come. Now, the Spanish are Christians. They say, hey, you know, we've got this belief system where we basically follow the teachings of this guy who said, you know, the meek will inherit the earth. Do unto others as you would like to have done to yourself. And we really think that this is a great message. So we want you to believe it, or we're just going to tie you to a post and set you on fire or hack your hands off. Isn't that bizarre? And I know I have a kind of a matter-of-fact way of telling these stories, but there's nothing funny about this. There's nothing amusing about this. This is absolutely horrible and shameful that when we're young, we learn that people like Columbus are in any way heroic. But boy, am I off track. I guess what I was saying is that these are places where the story of this American tradition or American heritage starts, right? Or, you know, you can do what the textbooks do and kind of smush them all together, cleanse them of all the gory details, and make it seem like it was part of some divine plan. Let's start with the founding fathers. And I was saying that we are taught to feel extraordinarily grateful for this bunch of freedom-loving, powdered wig-wearing visionaries who just care so much about equality and justice, and they kind of pave the way for the great society that we live in. And this is the way. This is the heritage. This is the story. Now, this group is presented as one thing. And all of these guys have the same vision of freedom. And for most people, that's it. There are no more details to be added later. That is what they understand about history. So now we go to level two, we'll say, where this might happen in really advanced high school history classes, or maybe more in college, or, of course, for people who are doing some kind of independent study. The next place they get to is realizing that this group of founders was not just one uniform group of people who all had exactly the same vision and all thought exactly the same thing. The greatest disparity is probably between Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, who, I guess, you know, from what I can tell, respected each other, but at the same time, they kind of hated each other's guts. Now, their visions of what America should be were just so different. So in school, basically what I've described so far is that we live in Thomas Jefferson's vision of America, right? We think about the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that just kind of is perpetuated forward into the future up to the present day, and that's the basic history. The Jefferson's rhetoric, Jefferson's words on paper, basically lay the groundwork for what America is. That's what we learn. So at this second level of understanding, we come to realize that there was a considerable amount of division between these people. And to make a long story short, we realize that we live in an America that is far closer to Hamilton's vision, which was, you know, central banking, imperialism, the political class being basically handmaidens to elites, pretty much the opposite belief system from what Thomas Jefferson wrote down on paper. And let's, before we even go any further, Thomas Jefferson is probably, of all these founding fathers, political class people, Thomas Jefferson is probably the most principled. And that speaks volumes about that group as a whole. Thomas Jefferson, hypocrite, right? He was very clever. He was a good writer. He had some great ideas for inventions to improve agriculture. But what's important to remember about Jefferson, just in a nutshell, when he wrote the words that all men are created equal, he owned 250 people. Now, that story is glossed over pretty much in public school history, and this is something that people might be made aware of in college. But I think that Jefferson believed what he wrote, that this idea of freedom or people essentially governing themselves was a much better vision of society than what people would have been used to in Britain. But those beliefs, or maybe even just those words on paper, would have made him the minority in this group of people that we usually consider the founders. The others, people like Washington and Adams, pretty much believed what Hamilton did. And Hamilton actually came along later. He's a little bit younger than the rest of these guys. Jefferson is actually a little bit younger than some of these guys too, but if I had to say one nice thing about Jefferson, I guess you could say that his rhetoric, like the stuff that he wrote in the Declaration of Independence, might have wound up acting as a sort of sticky tar on the bottoms of the black boots of state power that are always marching towards totalitarianism. In other words, the ideas that became attached to America because of what Jefferson wrote might have slowed that process down. Seems to be picking up pretty nicely now, but it's difficult to say. But that's about it. I don't have much nice to say about any of these people. Now, funny thing happens after the Revolution. Turns out that all of that stuff about liberty and freedom and equality, wouldn't you know it, just words on paper. Just kind of a rhetorical trick used by political elites to mobilize public opinion towards a goal that they wanted to achieve. And, you know, even in the decade after the Revolution, people realized that all of this nice stuff that Jefferson had written in the Declaration was not coming to fruition in this this new republic. You have Shays' Rebellion, you have the Whiskey Rebellion, people who thought that they could continue the same revolutionary spirit against authority found out differently. You have the Alien and Sedition Act of the John Adams administration, and then it is Jefferson's turn. So Will he turn things around after Washington and Adams? Will he get the country back on track towards the pursuit of the vision that he laid out in the Declaration of Independence? No, not really. I mean, not everything he does is awful, but the size of the country expands dramatically. New branches of the military become permanent fixtures. There's the first foreign entanglement that they all seem so against originally. I mean, were there reasons for the things that Jefferson did, like the war against the Barbary States, the Louisiana Purchase, the expansion of the military? Sure. There's always reasons for the expansion of state power, right? No one ever comes into power and says, all right, executive order number one, time for some crazy shit. Right? They always have reasons. There's always a reason for state power to expand, which is why we cannot afford to live in a world where state power exists. It always grows. We realize that the language of liberty was used as a tool to get ordinary people who had absolutely nothing to gain from the American Revolution to fight for it. In fact, if many of these revolutionary soldiers who were killed in battle were somehow revived and brought back to life to observe society here in 2010, based on the rhetoric about the British government and the rhetoric of liberty and freedom that they heard they were fighting for, their reaction would be, I guess we lost this fight. And, you know, how did the British government move here, and how did it get so big in just two centuries? But there was also a far more dangerous idea embedded into the rhetoric as well. And we have to pick that up a little bit later. I will come back to that because it's important. But just to check where we're at as far as these levels of realization are concerned about where the American way or the American tradition or the American heritage, whose vision of society do we live in? You know, the first thing is we learn that we are not the descendants of Greek gods, even though a class trip to Washington, D.C. might lead us to believe that with all its monoliths and statues and idolatry. The second level of realization is that the vision of America is crafted by somebody whose ideas were antithetical to the ideas of freedom that we're always told about. And the third step of realization is that the vision of freedom, of liberty, was not carried forward by the leaders who followed the founding generation anyway. You might be asking yourself, does it get any worse? Yeah, it does. There's another level. This is a level that I can safely say probably over 95%, at least 95% of people are never even made aware of. And it has to do with a story that I've already told you about the Prussian Empire. Groups of American educationists and intellectuals traveled to Prussia in the middle decades of the 1800s to basically make a carbon copy of their education system and bring it to the United States. Because this education system, going through the 1800s and really, really picking up in the 1900s, has become so widespread and so pervasive, it is safe to say that we are the inheritors of a vision of society designed by Prussian elites and intellectuals. And it's not pretty.
By 1900, most of the compulsory schooling laws that implemented the new system had been passed. From then on, every American child grew up under the Prussian system. So what exactly was the Prussian education system that everyone thought was so amazing that it just had to be adopted throughout the free world? To give you just a bit of background, in the 18th century, the Kingdom of Prussia, which is now modern-day Germany, was among the first countries in the world to introduce free and compulsory education. After the Prussians were defeated by Napoleon in 1806, it was decided that the reason why the battle was lost was that the Prussian soldiers were thinking for themselves in the battlefield instead of following orders. To make sure that this couldn't happen again, a new 8-year system of schooling was created. This new system provided not only the skills needed for the early industrialized world, such as reading, writing, and arithmetic, but also a strict education that taught duty, discipline, respect for authority, and the ability to follow orders. Elite children destined for higher offices went on to attend private schools, while the rest of the population had no access to the secondary education. They were destined for the working class. Through this new system, the Prussian court tried to create social obedience in the citizens through indoctrination. Every individual had to become convinced at the core of their being that the king was just, his decisions were always right, and the need for obedience paramount. In truth, the entire purpose of the system was to instill loyalty to the crown and to train young men for the military and bureaucracy. To do this, it was necessary to squeeze out all independent thinking from the masses. Influencing this new system from the beginning was Prussian philosopher Johann Gottlieb Fichte. Combining John Locke's view that the children are a blank slate and Rousseau's ideas on how to write on that slate, Prussia established an educational system that was considered scientific in nature. An important part of the Prussian system was that it defined for the child what was to be learned, what was to be thought about, and how long to think about it. In order to have an efficient policy-making class and a subclass beneath it, it was believed that one had to remove the power of most people to make sense out of the available information. In other words, critical thinking had to be done away with. Now, if you're wondering why the average person doesn't know that the North American education system is based directly on the Prussian model, it might just be because its original purpose was not designed for the good of the individual, but for the good of the government. The philosophy of Johann Fichte directly influenced the creation of the Prussian model of schooling. As he is quoted saying, "The schools must fashion the person, and fashion him in such a way that he simply cannot will otherwise than what you wish him to will." With quotes like these, you can see why his involvement is not well known. Education should aim at destroying free will, so that after pupils are thus schooled, they will be incapable throughout the rest of their lives of thinking or acting otherwise than as their schoolmasters would have wished. When this technique has been perfected, every government that has been in charge of education for more than one generation will be able to control its subjects securely without the need of armies or policemen. In 1807, in a Berlin occupied by Napoleon, Johann Fichte gave a series of famous addresses to the German nation. Fichte spoke of the superiority of German people above all others. The content of these speeches was a catalyst for the Prussian education system and German nationalism. In other earlier works, he calls Jews a state within a state that would, quote, undermine the German nation. He openly expressed a desire to expel Jews from Germany. Fichte had a deep influence on the rise of the Third Reich, and continues to be deemed, quote, the spiritual father of modern neo-Nazism. Which begs the question, why would the father of American education make it a law that every child spend their youth in a system created by the father of neo-Nazism? Historians reflect that one of the greatest social factors that allowed a man like Hitler to rise to power was that the German people had been bred from birth to respect authority above all else and accept it without question. Which begs another question. If the entire population of North America is raised in a system adopted from pre-Nazi Germany, what are we setting ourselves up for?
But where did these ideas come from? What is their origin? Like, if I just wanted to cast people as naturally evil and malevolent, I could have been like a speechwriter for George Bush or Rudy Giuliani. They live in caves. They hate us for our freedom. What, you need like a backstory? That should be scary enough. So we should try to put this vision that these Prussian intellectuals had in some kind of context. We should look for the origin of this idea that people as individuals are nothing, that they basically the citizenry is an abstraction, or at best a uniform and manageable collective that exists to work towards the goal of expanding the state or strengthening the state or maintaining the state. It's a seriously demented idea. And to find its origin, we have to travel to another place and back to another time. And some of you might find this kind of alarming where we're going. America. America at one of the most cherished times in its entire history, the time of the Revolution. Now, I might be making all of this sound a little bit simpler than it actually is. The founding fathers of the United States did not invent the idea of the state's needs superseding the needs of the people at the time of the Revolution. They actually pretty much borrowed this idea of state supremacy from Britain. And it wasn't even a new idea with the British. I mean, this goes back to the Roman Empire. But they added something to it that made it even more powerful. You see, at this time, the people who were pushing for a separation from the British Empire might have had a number of different goals. Some of them were land surveyors, and they had kind of, if you think about it, at this time, most people lived within 100 miles of the Atlantic Ocean. The Appalachian Mountains kind of provided this western frontier that very few people traveled beyond. And there was actually some restrictions placed on the colonists by King George that did not allow land surveyors west of the Appalachian Mountains. Another real cause of the Revolution is England's central banking, that the people who understood economics in the colonies, the elites, wanted to free themselves from. Strangely, they would try to replicate the British banking system with the Bank of the United States within a couple decades. But that's another story. But you can't mobilize ordinary people to fight for the economic interests of elites. Not now, not ever. So you got to come up with some kind of a story. So you take these ideals of Thomas Jefferson, or Thomas Jefferson's pen, rather, freedom, liberty, justice, equality. You wrap them up with this mystical idea of a national identity, and you have created a rhetorical package that you can use to mobilize people to fight for something that has absolutely nothing to do with their best interests. Remember, at this time in colonial America, there were people who lived in New Hampshire and Massachusetts and Connecticut who had gone their entire lives without ever seeing a British soldier. Of course, the British Empire was oppressive. It is one of the most horrid state powers in all of history. But the oppression of the average colonist is a myth that is largely invented. It just wasn't that palpable to the average person in the colonies. The way the history is presented, we're kind of led to believe that everybody here got shot in the Boston Massacre. But it's just not true. These were isolated events. But that's the trick. One more time. You take the powerful and the system that they want to use to exert their power. You attach it to the idea of national identity, and you attach that to the idea of the good cause or the virtuous endeavor. And then you hand people guns and tell them to start fighting for it. And you have allowed the most horrible atrocities imaginable to become very possible with that little trick. Americans at the time of the Revolution became known as patriots. The root fits into other words like paternal, paternity, patriarch. It means father. If you follow the etymology back to ancient Greece, you have patris, which means fatherland. The idea of violence mobilized and animated by emotions of belonging and hope of freedom spreads to France. It serves as the catalyst for the revolution there at the end of the 1780s. And while obviously false and entirely irrational, somehow validated by success through the revolutions in both America and France, it continues to spread east to Germany at the beginning of the 19th century. It's important to point out that Europe, for hundreds of years, had been divided or disconnected, organized merely into feudal kingdoms, or people lived under the rule of foreign or distant empires. This idea of national identity became a powerful one, and I think we can see, if we consider what a map of Europe looked like at the beginning of the 19th century and what a map of Europe looks like today, that this idea definitely caught on. The last time that I was talking about similar ideas, I think it was in an episode called The Pavement on the Road to Hell, maybe about 6 months ago. And I used a book called Ideas That Changed the World by Felipe Fernandez Armesto. And I mentioned that only a handful of pages had good ideas on them. I could estimate that pretty easily because I marked the pages, folding them over, the ones that had ideas that I thought were simply not completely insane. The page I'm going to read from is not one of the pages that I folded over. It's called My Country, The Idea of Nationalism. Armesto writes, "Nationalism was obviously false. There is no innate spiritual bond between people who happen to share elements of common background or language. Their community is simply what they choose to make of it. Yet for an idea so incoherent, nationalism had amazing effects. It played a part in justifying most of the wars of the 19th and 20th centuries and inspiring people to fight in them. Together with the doctrine of national self-determination, it shaped Europe after World War I and the world after the retreat of European empires. It seems increasingly irrelevant today in a world of globalization and internationalization, but some politicians, threatened with the need to pool their power, have rediscovered a certain nostalgia for the nation-state." And before I put the book away, why don't we flip ahead a few dozen pages to page 328, also not marked, to see where this kind of mystical idea eventually leads. This is called Master Race, the idea of German superiority. In the opening years of the 19th century, Germany was a stomping ground for the French and Russian armies. This humiliating experience provoked an intensely nationalist reaction, an attempt to show that, like all history's best victims, Germans were really superior to their conquerors. Germany, in many Germans' opinion, needed to unite and organize for resistance and counterattack. Meanwhile, inspired by Plato's theory of forms, German philosophers saw the Volk, German for people, as an ideal, a transcendent, immutable reality. The first rector of the University of Berlin, Johann Gottlieb Fichte, thought German identity was eternal and unchanging. To have character and be German were undoubtedly the same thing. That's a quote. The Volkgeist, the spirit of the nation, was essentially good and insuperably civilizing. Hegel thought that the Germans had replaced the Greeks and Romans as the final phase in the, quote, historical development of spirit. That sounds kind of familiar. Last best hope. Quote, "The German spirit is the spirit of the new world. Its aim is the realization of absolute truth as the unlimited self-determination of freedom." Unquote. Weird. This sounds very grand and a bit scary, There was no good reason behind it except for intellectual fashion. In other words, intellectual creation, something made up by intellectuals. And of course, these are the intellectuals, the people like Beach, who would have probably called himself a philosopher, that were also behind this establishment of the school system in Germany. So we see ideas that really are not new with the American Revolution, but really get some kind of validity because of how successful they are during the American Revolution and the French Revolution, spread from America to France, from France to Germany. They are packaged up in this education system and sent back to America. So that kind of brings us back to that question that I asked at the beginning of the show. What is this American way? See, the whole Prussian education system kind of misleads us into thinking that the Americans, the American government, or the American nation was somewhat pure before being infected by the Prussian education system brought here by Horace Mann. It's not true. There is no American way. There is no German way. There is no British way. There is only the way of statism. And they're all the same. Sure, there's different ebbs and flows and ups and downs and, you know, historical trends and anomalies, but it basically follows the same way, right? A path that starts out with reliance on theft, violence, and deception, and a path that ends at totalitarianism. That is statism. We're often told that America is the only country that was ever founded on a good idea, right? The idea of freedom. But we heard in that passage that we just read that the Germans believed it too. It's not, you have to wrap it up in some kind of good idea. People are good. People are generally good, moral beings that don't want to hurt other people, that don't want to aggress against other people. It's violent sociopaths that want to use this as their mode of operation. They have to wrap their agenda up in something that seems virtuous or noble, or they fail immediately. As Stefan Molyneux always points out, as soon as people can see the evil ceases to exist. So the evil always needs to wear some kind of costume. That is the way of the nation state. This is relatively simple. In today's show, I've played a few somewhat creepy audio clips. But this last one, while it might seem innocuous to the live audience listening to it, cheering frequently throughout it, I'd like you to listen to it and reflect on the things that we've talked about today. When I tell you that this is not some kind of audio presentation or recreation of a transcribed speech given 240 years ago by someone who was trying to whoop up some kind of revolutionary fervor amongst uneducated farmers in colonial America who lived hundreds of miles away from a book that wasn't the Bible. And when I tell you that it is not an English translation of a speech given by Joseph Goebbels or Adolf Hitler in Germany in the 1930s, when I tell you that it is a speech, a well-received speech that was given in 2008 in America, this should be the most haunting and most disturbing audio clip in the entire show.
My friends, I've been an imperfect servant of my country for many years, but I've been her servant first last and always. And I've never... I've never lived a day, in good times or bad, that I didn't thank God for the privilege. I fell in love with my country when I was a prisoner in someone else's. I loved it not just for the many comforts of life here. I loved it for its decency, for its faith, and the wisdom, justice, and goodness of its people. I loved it because it was not just a place, but an idea, a cause worth fighting for. I was never the same again. I wasn't my own man anymore. I was my country's. My country saved me. My country saved me, and I cannot forget it. And I will fight for her as long as I draw breath, so help me God. If you find faults with our country, make it a better one. If you're disappointed with the mistakes of government, join its ranks and work to correct them. Enlist in our armed forces. Become a teacher. Enter the ministry. Run for public office. Feed a hungry child. Teach an illiterate adult to read. Comfort the afflicted. Defend the rights of the oppressed. Our country will be the better, and you will be the happier, because nothing brings greater happiness in life than to serve a cause greater than yourself. I'm going to fight for my cause every day as your president. I'm going to fight to make sure every American has every reason to thank God as I thank him, that I'm an American, a proud citizen of the greatest country on earth. And with hard work, strong faith, and a little courage, great things are always within our reach. Fight with me. Fight with me. Fight for what's right for our country. Fight for the ideals and character of a free people. Fight for our children's future. Fight for justice and opportunity for all. Stand up to defend our country from its enemies. Stand up for each other. The beautiful, blessed, bountiful America. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up and fight. Nothing is inevitable here. We're Americans, and we never give up. We never quit. We never hide from history. We make history. Thank you, and God bless you, and God bless America.
John McCain ran for president in 2008 and lost. And considering his company for a moment, the man that he ran against and the man that they were both fighting to replace, even after listening to that clip, it's interesting to point out that it was McCain, out of these three men, who least inspired people to make comparisons between the United States and the Third Reich. Least inspired people to make that comparison. And whenever I've made this comparison, the reaction is very predictable. Outrage, indignation, shock, and awe. And often in the past, the people that I've said this to, usually older and seeing themselves as wiser, might feel obligated to share with me a little bit of German history. Because obviously, if I can make such a ridiculous comparison, I must not really understand German history. So maybe they would tell me something like, you see, Brett, the German people must not have been very well educated because they allowed themselves to be tricked or dragooned into these murderous and destructive imperial pursuits at the end of the 19th century and throughout the first half of the 20th century. They just kind of fell for it because they were told that it was the right thing or the noble thing or that it was necessary for their safety and security or the health of their state. And for some reason, they could never seem to look closely enough at the situation to see how much it was hurting them, while at the same time, how much it was benefiting the people in power. And wouldn't you know it, Brett, after an extended period of marching around and trying to stick their flags in different places, they found themselves in complete economic ruin. What some people might call the result of imperial overstretch, especially after World War I. Poorly educated and not understanding economics or historical causality, and desperate and panicked because of this economic crisis, they gravitated to the feet of anyone who promised that they could bring change, that they could set out on a new course, especially if the person had some really sharp oratory skills. Confused about international relations, they were crippled by fears of external threats. And again, they gravitated to the feet of anyone who could position themselves as a protector, who claimed that their goal was peace and security, but strangely at the same time, waged preemptive wars and invasions. And this person who is kind enough to be sharing this very educational story with me might also want to point out that the people in Germany didn't seem to value freedom or understand the real concept of freedom, which is why they were so shamefully tolerant of things like a slow but steady march towards a police state, based on the idea that the Germans were not just being threatened from external forces, but internal ones as well. It's why they accepted things like the Hindenburg's decree, which took even more of their civil liberties away. It's why they tolerated the establishment of prison camps that were said to be necessary to maintain the health of their society. It's why they tolerated armed men storming into the homes of innocent and nonviolent people and putting them in prisons because of their beliefs or their behaviors. It's why they were tolerant of school children being told that they should report parental behavior to the authorities. This failure to value or understand freedom permitted the government to attain the power to seize and detain anyone it wanted to within the country. The development of a slanted, relativistic legal system filled with ad hoc policies and gray areas, even allowing for legal proceedings to be conducted completely in secret because of their supposed sensitive nature. It was why they tolerated dramatic and what should have been startling increases in the amount of socialization and nationalization and government control over business and industry. And it was why, by the time they realized how dangerous the people in power really were and how much additional power they had seized, there was no political action that they could take to solve this problem. And of course, wrapping up this brief history of Germany, we can't forget that idea that the people had been force-fed for so long that they were somehow culturally superior, that their beliefs and ideals and values were better than those of other people. And didn't that just pave the way for them to go and commit atrocities in the name of spreading good ideas? But Brett, that was Germany. and this is America. And if you would take the time to learn about her heritage and strong tradition of freedom, you would certainly know that those kinds of things could never happen here.
Just a couple quick notes after the show, actually about this show. I had someone listen to it before I put it out, and they said it had what they thought was a little bit of a different tone, kind of like a more sarcastic, know-it-all, a-hole kind of a tone to it. So if that came through, I wanted to apologize, and this is a subject that I guess is pretty intense for me, considering the experience that I've had professionally as a history teacher. And the part that I wanted to address is the sort of know-it-all part. When it comes to this kind of stuff, nobody knows it all. And the truth is that there's plenty of very bright people out there who would have a much, much different interpretation of a lot of the topics that I went through in the last 50 minutes of this show. So I want to point that out. You know, like, I'm criticizing the way history is taught in school as it's sort of this all-knowing one story that everybody agrees on. So I don't want to make it sound like I have a version that everyone should agree on. And the other thing, too, that reminds me, with dates or numbers, like the number of Arawak natives who are living in the area that Columbus sailed into, there's a lot of debate about how many people were there, how many Native Americans there were in America before the Europeans came here. So if you have any questions about any of the numbers that I use, I'd be happy to talk about it. I really like this to be kind of an open forum, so please, any objections, any questions, let me know. The other thing is that I actually have kind of a correction to make while we're on this subject. A while back, months ago, I used a quote supposedly from John Dewey. It's something like, you can't make socialists out of individualists. People who know how to think for themselves spoil the collective harmony of society. Well, somebody sent me an email and said, do you have a primary source for that quote? And it occurred to me that it was something that I had just written down years ago, heard somewhere or read somewhere, and I really never knew where it came from. So I started researching, and you know, the truth is that I can't find a primary source for that quote. So there's a chance that it was something that somebody just made up to kind of encapsulate Dewey's philosophy in a nice, quick one-liner, which I think actually happens quite a bit. And that quote is pretty representative of Dewey's body of work and his philosophy, but whether it's an actual quote or not, that's yet to be determined. I will continue to look for a primary source. If anybody knows of a primary source for a quote like that or exactly that, I would be interested in finding that source. So other than that, thank you very much for listening to the show. I look forward to your comments and support. New website will be coming in hopefully, I know I keep saying a couple of weeks, but let's stick with that. In a couple of weeks, we will have a brand new website, far more interactive than what we're using now. Thanks to the people who are working hard on that, Ofer and Joe, and again, thanks to Jason Osborne, whose continuous support of the show has been appreciated and extraordinarily helpful. And hopefully, I will have something to plug for him soon. I would recommend going and checking out the trailer of the movie that he is actually putting together. It's called Charturum, and that is C-H-A-R-T-A-R-U-M. It's actually a zombie movie. And of course, zombie movies can be a little bit intense, but this also looks pretty funny. And that's a fine combination right there. so humorous that you might wet yourself, so action-packed that you might soil yourself. The trailer is on YouTube, and either way, have a change of pants nearby. Thanks for listening, and take care.